3 days after the events of 9/11, on September 14th, 2001, while serving as presiding bishop and therefore living in New York City, where the national offices of the Episcopal Church are housed, I and my wife got into the back of a pickup truck, and passing through police barriers, we made our way with several staff persons to what was to become known as Ground Zero. Our first stop was the Siemens Church Institute in Lower Manhattan, a ministry of the Diocese of New York. There we were to meet rescue workers, as they were called at that point, who were taking a rest, a break from their labors, and we were to pick up sandwiches and, for some reason, dry socks for those who were dealing with the aftermath at the site nearby. While there, I was asked to celebrate the Eucharist, which prompted the sacristan to ask, what readings did I wish to use? Without thinking, I replied, it is Holy Cross Day, and therefore the readings are determined. A number of the workers, firemen, police, National Guard joined us for the service. The gospel appointed for the day was the latter portion of the reading we have just heard from the Gospel of John, in which Jesus says, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people, all things to myself." Following the service, we drove to Ground Zero, and we passed St. Paul's Chapel, the oldest surviving church building in Manhattan. We delivered the sandwiches and the socks and said whatever we could say to be encouraging in that awful scene. And then as we returned, we again passed St. Paul's Chapel, and I noticed that the iron gate was open, and I tapped on the cab and asked the driver to stop so that I could get out and see if the church was open. I went to the door. It was unlocked. I entered. The church was undamaged. Curiously, closer to Ground Zero than many of the buildings that were further away, not even a pane of glass was broken. And yet, everywhere in the church, there was a fine gray dust. I made my way to the back, to the sacristy, and found that that too was unlocked. I went in. I found a scrap of paper. I wrote a note. Frank Griswold just stopped by, love and prayers. And as I left and started up the aisle, the priest in charge of the chapel appeared, and we fell into one another's arms and were just quiet for a few minutes. And then he said, "I am here and the church is open." And I said, "God bless you, that's all that you can do." And then I looked over his shoulder toward the altar, above which was a small Renaissance brass crucifix. And as I looked at it with the arms outstretched toward the disaster and horror that lay beyond the walls of the church, Jesus' words came back to me, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people, all things to myself." And at that moment, I suddenly realized I, as the presiding bishop, had very little to say, very little to do that could be actually useful or helpful, but that at least Christ could hold it all, the horror, the rage, the grief, everything that I could not possibly manage to bear all by myself. But it didn't end there. Within a week, this quiet, dust-filled space was alive with very high-end chefs who had volunteered to come and cook, and there were chafing dishes with flames flying upward with all sorts of strange things being prepared for the workers who'd never seen food like that before. And then there were massage therapists dealing with sore feet, and then there were members of the New York Orchestra in the sanctuary playing Brahms and Bach and Beethoven, and the whole place was alive in the most incredible way. And then I thought of another thing Jesus said: unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain, but when it dies, it bears much fruit. Yes, there was the loss of life, which in no way was minimized or forgotten, nor was the grief that endures to this very day. But in this space, there was a whole sense of this evil, this horror that had occurred, being offset, contradicted by human goodness and an outpouring of compassion and love and a desire to be with and for people in their need. And so I think in less dramatic ways of our own lives and my own life. And at this point, I'm old enough to look back on various events, both personal and ecclesial, that were difficult and painful to endure. And I'm sure any one of you can say the same thing about the seasons of your own life. The grain was in the earth, and there was no immediate fruit. And when the fruit did appear, it sometimes didn't appear as I expected it to. I hadn't been able to recognize grace sometimes as it offset losses or some kind of relinquishments. And I found myself asking, why is this happening? This isn't fair. How can I go on with this? Will it ever end? And then suddenly I found myself, and I still do, caught off guard. And something beyond my knowing or understanding sort of overtakes me. And I know deep within myself, though I can't explain it, what Julian of Norwich, that 15th century mystic, meant when she said, all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. Not that I knew how it would be well, but I knew somehow I was caught up in something that wasn't constricting and life-denying any longer. A kind of quiet confidence overcame me, which I realized was not of my own creation. I hadn't figured my way into it, it simply had happened. And so too, as our lives unfold, there are moments of relinquishment and loss, and we wonder how we can go on or what we're going to find on the other side. And yet, often there is that quiet voice that says, all shall be well, though we can't understand where it comes from or how it will work itself out. I wonder if Jesus, facing, as he did, opposition and hostility, found strength and courage and indeed consolation in the words of the servant in the second song from Isaiah, which we heard earlier in the service. There is a sense of confirmation as he looks at the words, as I'm sure he did, and sees his own call. And the words of the servant become his own. The Lord has called me before I was born. In the shadow of his hand, he made me a polished arrow. You are my servant Israel. Did Jesus, as he pondered these words, think of his unique relationship to God as the beloved? In some sense, in this passage, representing the nation through his own fidelity to God's will. My food is to do the will of the one who sent me and to accomplish his work, Jesus says at the beginning of the Gospel of John. And then there is the opposition he experienced, particularly from the priests and the religious establishment. Did the words of the servant, I've labored in vain, I've spent my strength for nothing and vanity, strike a chord within him as he wondered why the people to whom he'd been sent, the lost sheep of the house of Israel, could hear nothing of what he said? Did he hover, possibly those times of opposition and closed-mindedness and deafness, did he hover on the brink of despair and then catch himself or find himself caught possibly by the next phrase, in the song, "Yet surely my cause is with the Lord, and my reward is with my God." And that confirmation, that word of encouragement, allowed him to go forward. And then again in this same passage, there is God speaking to the servant, saying, "It is too light a thing to restore the survivors of Israel. It's too light to be confined within the religious context of Israel and to deal with the exiles. I give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth, a boundless embrace." Had the courage then, as Jesus read those words of the Canaanite woman, who, when he said, "I'm only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel," had replied, "Even dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." And had the Greeks who appear in tonight's reading from John, who were God-fearing Gentiles, not Jews, who wished to see Jesus, had the presence of Gentiles eager to be in his presence, allowed him to see in these encounters something larger than the confining ministry that he thought he was called to in the first place, and extended his sense of mission. Did the Lord's words to his servant find a deep and all-embracing yes within him? Yes, that's me. Yes, that's my call. It is too light a thing to restore the survivors of Israel. I give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. Yes, that is my call. That is my destiny. Jesus, in the fullness of his humanity, like us, in every way except sin, has to find his way as we do, step by step, day by day. The work to which he is called becomes clear only in the living of the next human moment, in a stance of availability to whatever may be revealed or demanded of him. And the same is true of us. Bit by bit, stage by stage, choice by choice, we make our way into the fullness of who we are called to be. Yet here I'm put in mind of the prophet Jeremiah, the complaining prophet who resented again and again the burden the Lord had placed upon him. And he says, and I love it, he says to God, "You've enticed me and I was enticed," or you can translate, "You duped me and I was duped. You caught me." And the prophet is angry. And I think, yes, there are times when God tricks us out of love and knows that if he gave the word too clearly to us, too directly, we would recoil and say, "Absolutely not." So he coaxes us. He opens the way bit by bit. He entices us. And so we move forward, stage by stage. I think here, too, of Jesus saying to the disciples, "I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now." God knows what we can bear. And so we are invited into collaboration with Christ, invited into God's desire for us, and through us, God's desire for others, bit by bit, as we are able to assimilate and take in the dimensions of call that we can endure. By means of all created things, without exception, the divine assails us, penetrates us, and molds us. Those are the words of Teilhard de Chardin, which I have recourse to from time to time, particularly when the going gets rough and I am resentful. I think even this is how I'm being shaped and molded, even though I can't understand in what way this is happening. Our God is a God of stealth at times, a God of wry humor, a wry humor which is rooted and grounded in a wild and all-embracing love. "The very circumstances of your life will show you the way," says an Orthodox priest. For Jesus and for us, life shows us the way. Relinquishment, losses, demands that exceed our perceived abilities. And then you know what? There's no manna unless you go into the desert. And you don't know what grace is unless you risk the going forth without knowing exactly how you're going to bear whatever is pulling you forward, whatever is drawing you. And yet, as we move forward, so often feeling totally inadequate, the grace is supplied. And rather than being diminished, we find ourselves in a fuller way. Something is your vocation if it keeps making more of you, says a character in Gail Godwin's novel, Evensong. And sometimes being made more of is painful. We would just as soon be our lesser selves, our minimal selves, but God says, no, you are coming forward and you are stepping out and you are going to become more than you think you could possibly be. So with Jesus, I think, he began in a very modest way, preaching, and then one thing led to another, and he was made more of, grew more fully into the mystery of his own identity, and finally was able to make his way to the cross, and even there was being made more of, as we see as he passes through death into resurrection. So again, it's a question of our own availability, our openness to the mystery of God in our lives, and we see in Jesus the model of availability and openness, and through the Spirit of the Son working within us, we are given the courage to say yes and allow Jesus to companion us so that we can grow in grace and truth into the fullness of who we are called to be. So again, I use, as I did last evening, the prayer of abandonment and availability written by Charles de Foucault. My Father, I abandon myself to you. Do with me as you will. Whatever you may do with me, I thank you. I am ready for all. I accept all, provided your will is fulfilled in me and in all your creatures. I ask for nothing more, my God. I place my soul in your hands. I give it to you, my God, with all the love of my heart, because I love you. And for me, it is a necessity of love, this gift of myself, this placing of myself in your hands without reserve, in boundless confidence, because you are my Father. And I'll make one final comment. I was speaking to the Service League at lunchtime, and we talked briefly about the Lord's Prayer and the whole notion of God's will, your will be done. And what is very important to be aware of is that in Greek, will has many meanings. And one of the meanings is to feel affection for. And so God's will for us is less a question of a plan that God has absolutely and checks it off when we obey. And it's more the feeling of a parent for one's children. And one's will for one's children as they flourish and grow. And as a parent, one knows that one can't protect them. One has to allow them to discover through trial and error their own way. And sometimes one has to be like the prodigal father's son, just waiting on the hillside, knowing that you can't intervene. And yet there is love always going toward the child. And so God's will in our lives, making ourselves available of God's will, is making ourselves available to infinite love, infinite care that goes with us everywhere. And when we stray, it is there, it waits for us, it welcomes us home, no matter what happens to us. And I think that's a healthier way to look at God's will as we seek to allow it to find a home in our hearts. Amen.